Hello, I'm Marc-Alain Trudeau. This is number 0227. The Softfire program with Peter Anthony Elder. It comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0227. And this is a very special edition of the Stuff File program. Yes, I know last week we had a special show too, when we put together the annual broadcast of the Meshach and Malik Christmas special, but this show is also rather unique. This is a best of show that looks back at some of the great guests we've been lucky enough to have for this program. You won't get any Stuff File news in this particular edition of the show. It's just going to be snippets of past programs, although I will revisit one of the favorite idiots of the day at the end of the show. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0227, was Marc-Alain Trudeau, who is a freelance television cameraman. And I thank you very much, Marc-Alain, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the program. Anyway, let's get right to the meat of the show. As we look back at some of the interviews done over the past year on the Stuff File program, a show that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, we start off with a guest from Stuff File number 0202, Scott Thorson. He was the former lover of Liberace. His story was recently in the spotlight again with the release of the successful HBO film Behind the Candelabra, which is based on Scott's memoir of the same name. Scott was recently in a little bit of trouble himself. When the HBO film was first aired, Scott was behind bars in Reno, Nevada, awaiting to be sentenced on burglary and identity theft charges. He was actually bailed out of jail by Dennis Hoff, the owner of the famed Bunny Ranch. When we spoke, I asked Scott if he was happy with his portrayal, as it was played by Matt Damon, to Michael Douglas's Liberace.
Yes, I was. I did this deal in 2008. And when I went to, when Soderbergh and Weintraub came to me, I says, I'll do the deal if you stay true to the book. And they kept their word, they did it. And I'm very pleased. I'm very happy. I've got the best producer, the best director, the best cast that money can buy. The box office theaters here in the States, they didn't want to touch the film. They said, oh, it's too gay. Now they're kicking themselves in the pants, and it's just it's HBO's game. I mean, it's just incredible, the response that we're getting from this. Pinch me. It doesn't seem real.
As I said, this story, the HBO film has put you back in the spotlight. So bring us up to date. I mentioned that you were actually recently in jail. What's the situation there? You're to be sentenced in July, I understand?
Well, here's what happened. Listen, in August 2012, I was dying of cancer. My doctors, they had no other choice at the time to put me on some really heavy-duty narcotics, Oxycontin and synthetic heroin. And unfortunately, I don't think anybody in life sets out to be an addict. But when we're under the influence, we do certain things that we normally would not do. And it was, I'm not going to get into details, but it wasn't that serious. The only reason why I was in jail was because of who I was. Anybody else, they would have been out. Very minor. But anyway, the lesson to be learned is just don't use drugs. And I've been clean now for 6 months. I've got a beautiful new start. And I'm very excited. I got a great new friend, Dennis Hoff, the Bunny Ranch here. And they've been fantastic to me. He's really a nice guy. And, having the best time.
Anybody who's gone, paid attention to the lawsuits you had back in the day against Liberace, anybody who's read your book, certainly anybody who's seen this recent film on HBO, they know how you met Liberace and what your life became because of that. Now, you were bailed out of jail by Dennis Hoff. You're now living at the Bunny Ranch. He's putting you up in one of the homes there. Doesn't this all sound familiar?
No, what do you mean?
Well, it's just that, I mean, isn't Liberace was taking care of you. Admittedly, there was a sexual connotation to the relationship. But isn't this someone else taking care of you again?
Dennis isn't taking care of me. It's a two-way street. Okay, you scratch my back, I scratch your back. Dennis, it's the first time in Nevada where the brothel and the gaming has been down. Dennis did me a favor by bailing me. I'm doing him a favor because I'm the hottest person in Hollywood right now, doing a little PR in exchange. I'm nobody's taking care of me. Mr. Hoff and I, we have a business arrangement, and that's what we're doing. Okay. We're having a great time.
Now, you're doing, if I'm not mistaken, a follow-up to your last book, which I believe is called Shattering the Candelabra?
It's going to be called Shattering of the Candelabra. We hope that we can get... excuse me. I got a wicked cold. We hope we can get Matt Damon. And if it all works out, it looks like, you know, it's going to go through, and it's going to be a very good... If you think Behind the Candelabra was good, wait until you see Shattering. It's going to be excellent.
Now... bring us up to date. You mentioned your problem with cancer, and of course that led to some drug issues. But what happened to you in between the time that we last heard about you, which was the court case, and more recently? What have you been doing all these years?
You mean the court case? You mean with Liberace?
Yes.
Well, after I went through all that. You got to realize one thing. I was very young. I was only 16 years old. This man takes me in, wanted me for his lover, his son, feeds me drugs through his plastic surgeon, has my face changed for reasons to protect him because he wants to throw the press out. Gets me hooked on drugs. He says he created a monster. He wants to protect his image now. So he discards me like I'm a piece of garbage, throws me out. Tells the world that I'm a disgruntled employee, that I'm a liar, that I'm a hustler, that I'm a gold digger. Basically blackballed in Hollywood. Now all of a sudden it all turns around because the truth comes out, what really happened. And I'm a strong believer in karma. And I think, it's amazing how it all turned out.
So what have you been doing in the intervening years? How have you been surviving and supporting yourself?
Well, I've been okay. I mean, I've had a prison sentence. I was shot 5 times. I was placed on the witness protection program. This is all going to be in the book. This is what sells books. This is what sells movies. You know, it's these stories, these incredible stories. And I was fortunate enough to survive it. It's going to be a powerful book, and the Behind the Candelabra stops in 87 when Lee dies. I write the book and then I publish it in 88. So that stops. There's no more, about my life. So it's going to be covering Michael Jackson. It's going to be covering my relationship with him. It's going to be covering the prison, the mafia. The Mexican cartel, all the stories of the Laurel Canyon murders, being shot, being placed on the witness, then going to the South, become a very successful evangelist with Billy Graham and Pat Roberts. And it's just going to be a really explosive movie.
Scott Thorson, author of Behind the Candelabra. We go from one person who had their battles with an entertainment icon to another who had battles with an entertainment institution. Actress Brenda Dixon is best known for originating the role of Jill Abbott on Young and the Restless, a character she played from 1973 to 1980, then again from 1983 to 1987. Brenda was fired from the show and blacklisted in Hollywood. She shares her story in her book, My True Hidden Hollywood Story, And on stuff file number 0203, I asked her why she waited until now to write her story since she hadn't been on the show since 87.
Because I was a little bit afraid of the whole thing, and I remarried and moved to Hawaii. It was all hidden, the blacklisting and the blacklisting trial, and everything is hidden, and I put it in the book, my firing. I'd given a year's notice that I was leaving, by the way. I wasn't staying on the show. They fired me to ruin my reputation, because when I left the show, I had a 7-year contract. I married and left for 3.5 years, and during that time, the ratings fell 6 points, and when I came back, almost immediately, they came back up the 6 points, and they'd never reached, they remained low. Those 6 points were low. Maybe for a week they'd come up, but basically they were low the whole time I was gone. And there was my character had changed into a villainess, a multimillionaire villainess, which was fine with me because I'd married a multimillionaire, and Bell followed my personal life, so he wrote that in too. And he wanted the old character that he did, and he was living in Chicago, and a bunch of other people were running the studio at that time in Los Angeles, and they made it difficult for me to perform unless I did, you know, pretty much what they wanted, and I thought it was right anyway because they had a whole new cast. They had Perry Lester, and they had all the Abbott family, and I thought it was best to be the villainess because they needed that character in the family, and it just kept getting worse and worse, and I had signed a 3-year contract, and at the end of my contract, I said, you guys are fighting over me so much because I brought the ratings in. The ratings went up 9 points when I became a villainess, so 3 more points higher, and Bell kept trying to sabotage that character and wanted his daughter to be a star on the show, and it just got out of control, and Jean was really ill. She was drinking just beyond, I mean, she was in blackouts and working, and the show was a mess because of these wars that went on in the show. So when I left, the ratings fell 9 points, and they never came back up, and Bell blacklisted me, and I know this because a press agent sent me to William Morris, and William Morris called Bell. This is how it works. And he said, don't hire her. She was a problem on her show. And this echoed all the way throughout Hollywood, and I couldn't get an agent. And 8 months after I was fired, I won Best Villainess, People's Choice Award, at Dick Clark Special. And so I was one of the most popular women in daytime, highest paid, and I couldn't get an agent in Hollywood. It was horrible. I sued him. My popularity, oddly enough, and I think it was 2007, something like that, they released a film called Welcome to My Home. And almost immediately, 3 million people viewed in. And so Sony Pictures took it off the airwaves, even though it was my film, and I did it after they fired me. And so I carried with me an audience that was more audience than the actual show itself, which ended up being at best 5 million, mostly 4 million. But when I left, it was about 3 million. They were losing money.
Okay, so
I'm sorry, I'm probably talking too much.
So you've now written this book, My True Hidden Hollywood Story, and the thing I'm surprised about is I mean, you played Jill Abbott on a daytime soap, and daytime soaps are known for having wild and extravagant plot lines, and it sounds like the Brenda Dixon story is far more, shall we say, larger than life than anything Jill Abbott ever did.
Yes, it is. It's beyond your imagination, and the way that they treated the actors behind the scene on that show, I wrote those chapters in because that when you read the behind the scenes of the set, it was incredible. But my story, when they got into my story, it was horrible that they would remain in my life the way that they remained in my life. And they even kept track of my life in Hawaii and wrote things, and you know, it was like I was some sort of, they were playing games on the set.
So okay. You have this battle with them, you go to court, you now write this book. With all that has happened, that, as you say, has happened to you vis-a-vis the Bells and what they've tried to do, blacklisting you and making sure you don't work, aren't you worried about more repercussions now that you're getting the story out there?
No, I'm not, because I think that I think the mistake that I made, and, you know, so many girls in Hollywood have gone through this. One of the people that it worked out really well for was, say, for instance, Valerie Harper, who opened her mouth immediately. You know, the problem with me is that everything was hidden by my attorney who actually worked for William Val. So the problem was everything was hidden because I had so much power. When they fired me, if I'd opened my mouth immediately, the audience would have, well, they clicked off anyway, even without me opening my mouth. But can you imagine? I mean, the show would have been over.
You kind of had to, because of what happened to you, put your career on hold. Would you like to ratchet up your career again as an actress? And if so, what would you like to do?
Well, I don't know. I haven't really got to that point yet. I'm still in court with my ex-husband. I don't know what I'm going to do next. I'll probably do film or nighttime television series. I won't do another daytime. That's for sure. Too much.
Actress Brenda Dixon, sharing a bit of her story and her book, My True Hidden Hollywood Story. Okay, we go from that appearance to a non-celebrity. People who know me know that I like to wear interesting neckties, even in my job as a television news anchor at Global Montreal. Well, one of the places I like to get my ties is from an online company called Infectious Wearables. I first became aware of them back in 1999 when they started. I had the founder of the line, Dr. Roger Freeman, on my old radio show. He was just starting up his new company of infectious wear, silk and cotton garments featuring patterns as seen under a microscope, ties that depict gonorrhea, malaria, the black plague, and herpes, just to name a few. I thought it would be interesting to get an update on how the company was doing, so we had him back on Stuff File number 0180.
When you first purchased one of our ties, we were in our infancy. I mean, we had just begun. And most of our materials were in infectious diseases because that's how it was started out early on with the previous developer and the CDC working in conjunction with each other. But we decided to change the emphasis and go to not only infectious disease, but things that we could talk about that were timely in which our humor could be sort of infectious. And so we've developed into subjects such as climate change and neurons and things of that nature, which has a more universal appeal and interest. And it's been an interesting ride. We've been very successful, and I'm you know, pretty excited that we've lasted this long.
Now, as you mentioned, I do indeed have one of your ties, and that's one of the reasons why I decided to call you again, because in my other life, I also work as a television news anchor and occasionally wear the tie that I purchased from Infectious Wearables. And I find it interesting, while wearing it on television, every once in a while I'll get an email from someone who is clearly in the medical profession, and they won't ask me what's on the tie. They just want me to confirm, is that Staphylococcus on your tie?
Well, you know, the images in the scientific community are pretty well known, so I get that all the time, and people, you know, when they email us and talk to us about their experiences, it's been really interesting over the years, the various experiences people have had and the feedback that they get. And that's what's been kind of exciting, Peter, is that people start to recognize it and they start talking about these things. I mean, we were at a charitable event with a bunch of lawyers not too long ago, a lot of lawyers. That was not really exciting for me. But three of them were wearing these ties because they had a connection to me. And they all started talking about the various issues on the tie. And really, that's very rewarding for us, to get people to be able to start talking about things over a subject that, how else would that subject come up in a group of lawyers at a charitable function?
The thing that's interesting about them is, on paper, it doesn't necessarily sound like a great idea, but when you actually see the ties, they really are gorgeous.
I know, and when people ask what it is that I do now that I left the profession of dentistry some time ago, and I tell them, well, you know, we've developed this little internet business. We thought back in 99 that might be something to be worthwhile. And then I describe what it is we do. I sometimes get a look that's like, no one home. What is it that you do again? And until they see the product, it's a hard connection for them to make.
Now, as I mentioned, you have ties. You have silk and cotton garments, so you have ties and you have scarves. What sells more? Do the guys buy the ties, or do the guys wear the ties, or do women buy the scarves?
That's really an interesting question. You are an insightful guy, Peter. When we go to the meetings like at American Public Health or microbiology meetings, guys will buy ties for guys. Guys will stand there with their cell phones and call their significant others and ask them what colors do they like, meaning the guys that don't even know what colors they like. But guys will not buy scarves. Women will buy ties for their significant others, and they will buy scarves. So it's sort of a one-way thing. Guys don't buy scarves, but women will buy ties. In fact, I think the women buy more ties than the men.
Really?
They buy them for the men. Yeah, I think so.
What is the most, over the years, what has been the most popular? I know when I first talked to you back in 1999, I think you had a favorite. You liked the gonorrhea tie.
Well, you know, I'm glad your listeners understand what we're talking about.
Yes.
Taken out of context, that's a little peculiar. But, you know, I do have some favorites in terms of design because I think they're clever. Right now, one of the most popular ones is the neurons design because it really is an image of neurons. And we're working at the moment with a group called the Facial Pain Association. They deal with a condition called trigeminal neuralgia, which is a very, very nasty condition. As it happens, my wife has it. But these neurons depict what axons and dendrites, what it actually looks like. And we sell those across the board because it's not necessarily an infectious disease. The design for climate change is very clever. It's got a polar bear on a little plank of ice. We've got West Nile. The images came directly from the Purdue department that did a lot of the Nobel Prize-winning research on West Nile. And that's been rewarding, too. We work with a lot of the scientists, across the world, really, on some of these designs. And we try to keep them as accurate as we can.
So the one for climate change, then, is that one of the first ones that you have that doesn't come from something that can be seen under a microscope?
That's true. It is. However, what it does have is it has a little graph on it, and I've forgotten the name of it. I'm ashamed to tell you the name of this graph. That shows the climate change over the last 100 years. It's very small, and you have to use a magnifying glass to see it, but it has that along with the polar bear, and there's one other component that I can't remember, but it's pretty neat, if I do say so myself. And we did that also in conjunction with Nobel Prize-winning scientist.
Roger Freeman, the man behind Infectious Wearables. Like I said, you have to check out their website to see the beautiful selection they have. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0227, and you'll find links to the site. There's more Best of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, coming up. In just a moment.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
coming to you from Canada, the land of universal health care, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
This is a special best-of edition of The Stuff File program, looking back at snippets of some of the interviews we've done over the past year on the show. Up next is someone you may recognize if you grew up watching The Facts of Life. Comic and actress Jerry Jewell is best known for her role as Cousin Jerry on the hit NBC sitcom. She was the first person with a disability to have a regular role on a primetime series. Earlier this year, she had released her memoir entitled, I Am Walking As Straight As I Can, Transcending Disability in Hollywood and Beyond. One of the things I asked her was if writing this book gave her the opportunity to learn anything about herself.
Oh, of course I did. The whole process was a catharsis. It was healing. And I also was able to look at things in hindsight, look at them through a different pair of eyes than I lived through it at the time, if that makes sense. So it was very healing, and I believe that it, my intention. I was very aware of my intention in writing it, and I wanted it to be sort of a healing experience for all people who go through it as much as I did, if not more. But there's light at the end of the tunnel, and the important thing is to get up every morning and do the best you can and forgive and move forward.
You started as a stand-up comic. You work as an actress. You've done so much. It's a very, very tough profession that judges people to the nth degree. As being someone who has cerebral palsy, a lot of people don't have the fortitude who are able-bodied to say, I'm going to put up with all the rejection and back-talking that I'm going to get. What is it about your character that made you persevere?
Well, I think it came from my childhood and my early intervention with occupational therapy and speech therapy and physical therapy. And it was ingrained in me to keep going, to go after things, to complete, to continue. I mean, I had that fortitude from the time I came into the world and was fighting for my life just to live, because I was born 3 months premature. I had lack of oxygen to the brain. I got pneumonia, and I was fighting for my life as a preemie. So I always had that fight and perseverance, and that's the beauty of disability, is that it can build tremendous strength and perseverance and life.
Have things changed since you first started, first in stand-up and then acting? If you were to start now as a comic and also as an actress, would the road be as difficult dealing with or having people deal with your disability as it was back when you started?
Well, truthfully, I think the road is a little bit easier now because some of the heavy doors were knocked down by myself and other people who started early on. But at the same time, it's a different world, and even comedy is different today. And, you know, I'm from the old school. So I look at the comedians today and I think they have it harder than I had it.
Why do you think they have it harder than you did?
I think because on the whole, comedy clubs are, I think it's important to build seats rather than if you're funny or not, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
So in that respect, it's a very, very different world. I never had to create my own audiences. The audiences were there. And today, I believe the business of comedy is they expect the comedians to fill the seats. I don't know if I could have done that.
Do you think it's a double-edged sword today? You talk about free speech. You think it's a double-edged sword? We've become such a politically correct society, and on the other side of the coin, we're sort of taking away a little bit from free speech?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree with that. And I also agree with the intention of the word. What was the intent of saying it? And we've become so paranoid of saying the wrong thing, we don't want to say anything. So it inhibits us from that freedom. But on the same token, there are some words, no matter how you say it, it's not to be said. So I don't agree with it 100%, but yes, it has stifled us of our ability to be more free on stage. Absolutely.
Comic and actress Jerry Jewell. Once again, her book is called I'm Walking as Straight as I Can, Transcending Disability in Hollywood and Beyond. You can check out Jerry's site at jerryjewell.com. Jerry is someone who makes people laugh, and laughter is very important. Albert Nirenberg is a journalist, a director, and a laughologist. If you're not quite sure what that last one was, well, you're not alone. Laughology is the science of laughter. Albert made a film about it, but since then has become quite an evangelist on the topic. So back on the Stuff File number 0181, I asked him how laughter has changed his life.
It completely changed my life. It sounds weird, but I would say this is the best explanation, is that I think I used to wake up thinking, you know, the moods that you wake up with are the moods that you get. You can't really affect your emotions. And when I learned about sort of the positive effects of, let's say, laughter exercise or laughter-size or laughing more, I realized that you could actually change yourself to be in happier, more joyful moods, especially if you laugh. And you can laugh by yourself, you can laugh in groups, you can do laughter workshops, you can laugh at the craziness of it all, you know? And so it was, really was life-changing. And one of the problems, I think, too, is I also worked as a professional journalist. And it's one of the great professions where they describe, where it's one of the few professions where it's important to be serious, where people would say, are you a serious journalist? And I think I was a serious journalist. I used to see my job as very serious, and I'd take myself a little too seriously. And now laughter is seen as really both a kind of psychological antidote to seriousness and an actual real antidote to seriousness, in the sense is now a physical profile for being too serious, that laughter changes in terms of the actual way that your cardiovascular system works. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. Now, when I've seen stuff that you've done online or on your website, I think one of the things that often comes up, people say, well, you really can't force it. But I've got a theory, and let me put this out to you and see what you think. It's not a situation where people are forcing laughter. I think it's quite the opposite. I think it's people who, I think laughter is natural, and people have learned to repress it.
Well, you're dead right. You are exactly correct. I mean, you said it, basically. That's the issue, is that by our very nature, there's a lot of hard science that shows that human beings are extremely playful animals, and we are naturally very inclined to laugh and have fun. But we live in a civilization that has become extremely serious and has trained us to be overly serious. And that seriousness is everywhere, and we think it's normal, but in fact it's the other way around. And that's what you discover when you start. There's now a movement called the laughter movement, which is, you know, everywhere in the world now. It's only about 15 years old, has a very precise beginning, that is out to sort of change all that, to make people more laughy. But there is some truth. When people say you can't force it, they actually do make sense. What they're actually saying is that you can't. There's a sort of belief that you can't just make yourself laugh on the spot. Well, now there are techniques such as laughter yoga, laughter size, the laughter party. That's what they're about. They're about being able to just make yourself laugh spontaneously, for no reason, basically. They're exercise for laughter, and that's the breakthrough, because 20 years ago, these things did not exist. And when I did the documentary, I tried them all. That was sort of my experience. And I realized, wow, there really is something here. And you can force laughter, so to speak, into making yourself laugh quite spontaneously, almost for no reason. And it's fun.
Okay, so when you laugh spontaneously, almost for no reason, how do you prevent other people from thinking you're crazy?
Well, they do sometimes think you're crazy. They do think you're crazy, but that's why you do it in the context of a workshop or something like that. I would say that the way it changes you is that is that, like, let's say you belong to a laughter yoga club or a laughter yoga group or a laughter, you know, you basically you're just more of a laughter-oriented person after that. And it's not that you then walk around laughing all the time and looking insane. What's more what happens is that you, so I'm just trying to find a quiet place. It's more that when you, next time you get the opportunity to laugh, you really go for it. You find yourself laughing harder and louder than you did before. That's a big difference.
Now, you say this is something that's spreading around the world. Are other parts of the planet more prone to laughter or laugh easily, more easily than other places?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I would say in terms of the movement, there are places that are bigger and smaller. Canada is actually quite a big country in terms of laughter groups, has a lot of them. And America is pretty big, and then there are places that don't have very many. But they're what's interesting is they're in places you wouldn't expect, like Iran. Apparently Iran has a very powerful laughter club. Beirut has a good one. But the other thing is that there are places in the world where people just laugh more naturally. For example, I would say the continent of Africa. In Africa, when I was in Tanzania, there was even a phenomena of an international laughing epidemic where basically back in 1962, about three people started laughing in a school in Tanzania, and it spread to the entire school, then it spread to the whole village, until it spread to parts of northern Tanzania and southern Uganda, until 40,000 people were laughing nonstop. It went on for months. And that's something that can happen in Africa. Africa has laughing epidemics. This is a little-known fact. Africa has laughing epidemics quite regularly.
Is laughter contagious?
It is absolutely contagious, but the proof was only made in 2006. Some British scientists were actually able to demonstrate that it was actually contagious. But yes, it's powerfully contagious, and apparently it is different from other contagious behaviors. I'll give you an example. You know, if somebody gets angry at you, you might feel angry too, meaning they've kind of infected you with anger. But you don't get angry the same way. If somebody laughs with you and triggers you to laugh, your whole behavior will change. Your breathing, your muscles of your face, your muscles in your mouth will all be triggered into a certain behavior. And that is unique to laughter in that it produces, the contagion produces a behavior, which is quite amazing.
Laughologist Albert Nirenberg. Again, you can find out more information by going to the website at laughology.info. We have more of our special edition of the Stuff File program, a best-of retrospective, looking at some of the interviews that we had over the year. That's coming up in a bit.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. One of the songs we hear a lot of during the holidays reminds us that this is the most wonderful time of the year. I agree, but in addition to being a wonderful time, it's also the most warningful time. That's right, full of warnings. Many of the gifts we'll be exchanging with each other come loaded with warning labels, and some are downright wacky. As the creator of the annual Wacky Warning Label Contest, I want to remind you to keep an eye out for funny warning labels. Many of the people who won the $1,000 grand prize in our contest in the past found their warning label during the holidays. One label was found on a live Christmas tree. It warned, "Not intended for human consumption." Now, let's be fair. I can understand the need for a warning like that on some of the fruitcakes I've tasted, but on a live Christmas tree? Come on. Learn how you can enter our contest by visiting centerforamerica.org. And from all of us at the Center for America, happy holidays.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Welcome back to a special best-of edition of the Stuff File program. Earlier this summer, a cultish, wacky TV movie took the world by storm. I'm talking about the sci-fi network's Sharknado. One of the stars of the film was actor Robbie Rist, a good friend of the Stuff File program. You might best remember him as a child star when he played Cousin Oliver on The Brady Bunch back in the 70s. Well, on Stuff File number 0206, we caught up once again with Robbie, and we asked him what was it about the script of this weird little movie that said to him, "I've got to do this part."
Well, actually, I kind of got into it in a roundabout way. I have been doing music for Anthony C. Ferrante's movies up until now. I also did, I wrote and performed six songs for Sharknado. And I was actually talking to another production company back east about 6 months ago or so, and you know, before Sharknado was a movie, it was a poster. That's kind of how the Asylum sold, you know, how they got their funding, is they made this poster of the shark with the tornado with the sharks in it, and said, enough said, and this guy saw the poster, and he's a big genre fan, as am I, and he was like, oh my God, did you see the Sharknado poster? I'm like, what is Sharknado? He goes, it's a tornado with sharks in it, and my head exploded. And then a little later on, Anthony C. Ferrante, who I've done all this music for, all these movies, said, yeah, you know, I'm kind of in the running for directing Sharknado. And I grabbed him by his lapels and I said, you must make this movie. And if you must make this movie, I must be in it. So he actually wrote me the part.
Excellent.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, you know, I had no idea all of this was going to happen again. I seem to keep stumbling into things that sort of hit the popular culture. You know, I mean, there's the Brady Bunch thing and the turtle thing and now this. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, we should mention that you were the voice of Michelangelo.
Mm-hmm. Yep, in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies. Yeah.
Exactly. So you've had I guess you've had the kind of career that fanboys love.
Yeah, I like I said, I keep stumbling into these things that kind of hit the cultural zeitgeist, you know? I mean, you know, Brady Bunch is now 40 years ago when I did it. And strangely, we're still talking about it. And in these, you know, in these times of information and technology moving so quickly, I mean, 40 years is about 70, 80, 90 lifetimes at this point.
Absolutely. Now, so
at least for you know, at least for something that's popular culture, you know what I mean?
Working on a film like this, it's a situation where technology really is involved in making a movie with post-production, with CGI. So even though you knew what the story was going in and you worked on the film, was it a bit of a surprise seeing the final project?
Oh, completely. I've actually never been involved with, you know, a really big effects film like this. Although, you know, I'm aware of the technology and how it all works, and you know, I teach acting too, and one of the things I tell, you know, fledgling actors is acting is really just playing cowboys and Indians, but you're a grown up. It's like when you're a kid, you know, and your parents get a new appliance like a refrigerator. If you end up with the box, that box becomes a fortress, a castle, a rocket ship, whatever. And the crazy thing about it is at that age, it's not a box. It really is a rocket ship. It really is a castle. It really is. So so a lot of these new movies, you know, I mean, you're acting to tennis balls all the time.
Wow.
You know, and then, I mean, like, you know, in the scene that I was in, there was no water at all. And there was no water, no sharks, just, you know, just dry land and me attached to some crazy harness. So, I mean, seeing all of the effects that they put in and for the amount of money that they did. You know, the crazy thing about Sharknado is the guy who wrote it didn't want to direct it because he said at the budget that they had, it was impossible to make. Mm. And a few directors went through their office and Anthony was the guy who said, what are you talking about? I can do this. And he delivered huge. I mean, you know, there was actually a bigger audience for it the second showing than the first. So that means by just sheer word of mouth, the thing grew.
Well, that's the interesting thing because social media had a big role to play in the popularity of this film, and it's a double-edged sword because there were some people who were really enjoying the fun that Sharknado was all about, and there were those who were mocking Sharknado, and that in turn turned into appreciation for the film, it seems.
Sure. Well, I think there is, I mean, at the end of the day, Sharknado is a B-movie, and, you know, B-movies, you know, are watched for all kinds of reasons. What the great thing I find about B movies usually is that they're usually such high concept ideas that they almost can't pull them off anyway because no one's going to give them any money to do so. So I think there's people that appreciate the sort of like high conceptitude. That's a word. Sure it is. You know, the high concept nature of it. Other people just like some of the groany dialogue. You know, they had to do this thing. They shot it in 18 days. And the script was written fairly quickly. And I'm really impressed with what they managed to pull off. Considering, you know, the budget they had, because I, you know, I've been in multi-million-dollar studio movies, and Sharknado is truly the little movie that could. I mean, yes, it blew up on social media, but I think it, because of it being in the middle of a summer, and you know, there were a lot of kind of crazy news events going on, and a lot of the summer blockbusters weren't doing as well as they could. I think the public was just ready for something that they could all, you know, unite under.
You also used the term a little while ago that you don't hear too much of because the old double features are gone. You used the term B-movie. And yes, this is a classic B-movie, but unfortunately in this day and age, some people, when they hear the term B-movie, they think it's second class, second grade. There are good B-movies. Just because a movie is a B-movie doesn't make it a bad movie.
Complete. Oh, the Evil Dead series. Those are B-movies. They're great movies.
Exactly.
Sure.
So I think people are enjoying Sharknado for exactly what it is.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, it definitely... I was doing an interview last week about it, and... one of the things that I love about Sharknado and movies of its ilk is that in three syllables, Sharknado tells you everything you need to know about the movie, where A Trip to the Bountiful doesn't.
Actor Robbie Rist. Now, there's a guy I always have time for. He's just one of the coolest dudes you will ever talk to. He's in Sharknado, and he's busy doing a lot of other projects as well. Finally, Rose Marie celebrated a milestone birthday. She turned 90. She's best known as a regular on the classic Dick Van Dyke Show, but she was also a regular on the long-running Doris Day Show in the late 60s. So on Stuff File number 0207, I asked her, what was it like working with Doris?
Absolutely the greatest. She was the most wonderful. She is the most wonderful person. And the way you see her is exactly the way she is. She's sweet and wonderful and lovable. And we got along just great. And we were very funny with one another. In fact, when I called her, she said, I missed the fun we had, you know. We talked to one another every once in a while. And she said, I missed the fun that we had because we laughed all the time. She's the most wonderful, underrated actress that ever happened. Mm-hmm. Nobody gives her credit for how good she is.
You know, we often talk when we look back in television and we look at working women portrayed in TV. We often talk about Mary Tyler Moore and her breakthrough television show when she did the Mary Tyler Moore Show. But before she became a working woman, you were a working woman.
Oh, I was the first lady. I had an equal job with the boys. I made the same money. I was treated as one of the boys. I was the first woman to be like that, in the country.
A lot is often made about being the first and breaking through the glass ceiling. Did you ever feel any pressure in succeeding in the character that you played on the Dick Van Dyke Show?
Never. Everybody just thought it was very funny. I get mail from... It's funny, I get mail from 15, 16 years old, 14 years old, telling me how wonderful I am on the Dick Van Dyke Show. They all watch the reruns, and they say, it's too bad television isn't that good today. And these are kids that are 13 and 14 and 12, and I'm amazed that they know the difference. They say, we wish they had more of the Dick Van Dyke type of shows.
The character you play, the quick-witted comedy writer Sally Rogers, how close was Sally Rogers to Rose Marie?
Same one.
Really?
Same one. I just played me.
How did you get the role?
Very easy. No, I can't say it was easy. I used to do a nightclub act around the country, and I used to play the flamingo. I opened the flamingo in 1938, I think it was, for Bugsy Siegel. And I used to play Vegas 5-6 times a year before it was a desert. And everybody knew that I played with Flamingo so many times. And I must go back. Danny Thomas was a hot flash comic in Chicago and was coming to New York as the new White Hope as a comedy. I opened for him at the Martinique in New York. We became very good friends. When he came out here to California, he had his radio show and television show, and I kept saying to him, when am I going to do your show? You have everybody on the show but me, and we're friends, we're like family, and you have everybody but me. And he always used to say, your time will come, your time will come. And one day, I got a call from the casting office, and they said, go down to Desi Lou, Danny Thomas. I said, oh, I finally got the guest shot. She said, no, this is for a new show called The Dick Van Dyke Show. I said, what's a Dick Van Dyke? And she said, just go down there. So I met Carl Reiner for the first time, and Sheldon Leonard, who was also the producer, he said to Carl, he said, if you want the best, get Rose Marie. I didn't read. I didn't have to do anything. The part was mine the minute I walked in. And then I said, who did that for the third writer? They said, we haven't cast him yet. And I said, what about Maury Amsterdam? I said, everybody in show business knows him. He's one of the greatest writers that ever happened. He wrote to Fanny Bryce and Fred Allen and people like that. And then I guess he decided to become a comic himself. But nobody in the world knew Maury Amsterdam, just show people. So I said, get Maury, he would be just great. They said, do you have his number? And I said, yes. And I gave it to him because Maury and I have been friends since I was 11 years old. Maury used to write all my material for my nightclub act. And I'm his daughter's godmother. So we were very close. I called him up and I said, they're going to offer you a show called The Dick Van Dyke Show. He says, what's a Dick Van Dyke? I said, I don't know, but we're going to do it. And he says, I'll be out Monday. I said, fine. And that's how he got the part. And that's how I got the part.
You mentioned he was writing for you since you were 11 years old. You actually started on stage at the age of 3, correct?
That's right.
So you've had a very long career.
I won an amateur contest when I was 3. I sounded the same way I sound today. I sang the way I sing today. And everybody said, that's not a child, that's a 35-year-old midget. So I had to go on a tour of the latter part of vaudeville to prove that I was a child, because everybody thought I was a midget. I had my own radio show when I was 5 years old, coast to coast on NBC, and a 15-minute program on Sunday morning with a piano player and an announcer, and me, and I sang 2 or 3 songs. And that's when people wrote in and said, that's not a child. That's got to be a midget. She sounds too old to be a child. So NBC was affiliated with RKO, and so I did all the RKO theaters across the country for a year to prove I was a child.
Wow, very impressive. Now, again, going back...
I can't talk, right?
Absolutely. Going back to the Dick Van Dyke Show, the show ran for 5 years, and it was still very, very popular when it went off the air.
We could have gone 2 more years at least, because we were never in color.
Was it bittersweet when the show went off the air?
Oh, everybody was very sad. Very sad, but I think it was Carl who decided that we sort of ran dry. Because he wrote all the scripts, you know, and he thought that we couldn't go any further. And he said, this is the last year. And everybody said, it's ridiculous. We can go 2 more years. And Sheldon Lennon said, they'd back up the Briggs truck for Dick if he would go, you know. So we didn't do the last 2 years. We did 5 years. 5 years of the happiest time of my life.
Comedic legend Rose Marie, as she celebrated her 90th birthday this past summer. I hope you enjoyed this look back at the Best of the Stuff File program. And of course, all previous Stuff File programs are available online, so you can listen to them whenever you'd like. Now, I did promise you a favorite idiot of the day to end things off, so let's get to it. Time now for our Retro Idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
This gem comes from Stuff File number 0195. The Narcotics Task Force of Jackson County, Mississippi, arrested 41-year-old Henry Ha Nien in April as the operator of a large marijuana grow house, a facility that would normally reek of the distinctive pot fragrance. However, Nien had thought of that and tried to mask the smell, but chose the alternative scent produced by buckets full of what appeared to be human feces. Now, why would someone think that the aroma of copious amounts of human feces would be less of a red flag than the smell of large amounts of marijuana? Well, one reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0227. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0227. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.